Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 21st of May. And it's great to be back. I was away for 5 days, and it was a lovely, lovely vacation. I went to England and to London specifically with my wife and two of my nieces. One niece graduated from college, and we asked her what she wanted for her graduation gift, and she said, "I'd like to go to London." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, that seems nicer than the earrings we were going to buy you." And then she said, "Oh, can my sister come too, who just finished her first year at the University of South Carolina?" And so we went down, and we had a lovely, lovely time. And now we and 2/3 of my luggage are back. And we're thrilled to be back and back in the saddle. And we had a lovely, lovely time. And I just want to thank Sarah and the whole team for filling in while I was away. That was very, very nice. And it's good to get away for a couple days. And also to sort of get this perspective of the world outside of our immediate political situation. And it's not better. it's still murky and messy over there too, but it is. But it was interesting to compare and contrast. So thank you very much. Obviously, you know the lockbox is going on. We're going to continue talking about the lockbox throughout the morning. Both Ray and Sarah will be back at the bottom of the hour and be talking to you again. This is where we live. This is the important part of what we do. And as you know, we're under the microscope, and this is something that we're doing to save public media and to save public radio, and most importantly, I think, for all of us, to save WAMC. So, and I use the word save in the way of that it's important that we protect it and make sure that it will have a long and fruitful life in the future. And that comes from you. We're losing support in a lot of different places, and we're making that up in different places. And whatever you can do to help out in that regard is much appreciated. I'll let Ray and Sarah explain more about that at the bottom of the hour. Let me introduce everybody to you, and we'll get started on the news of the day. Communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore is with us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm great, Joe. Good morning. So I'm glad to know that, I hope that 2/3 of your luggage that has made it from England included your raincoat.
Yes,
because
it
what
did.
You brought from England, along with 2/3 of your luggage, is England's weather. So
yes.
Next time, stay another couple of days.
Well, I will say, though, that I just found the weather to be like a through line. After, you know, it's been a rainy April and most of May now. And so going over to England was just sort of a continuation of what we've had. It was, you know, moments where it would get a little warm and then cooler and cloudy and then rain. So, but yes.
I'm wondering if
are you giving me an excuse to stay over there longer? I think that's...
Well, absolutely. Or to just not go and leave us. Now, but here's the other thing. So when you come back from England, right, your body has to adapt to the time change.
Yeah.
Is it easier when the weather's exactly the same?
No. My body feels like it's been run over by a truck, and I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily what they would refer to as jet lag. I just think it's trying to put a big ass guy in a tiny plane, and then just shaking it for 7 hours.
Yes,
they shove you into this space where just your head is sticking out, and then they just shake you, and then you get off, and it's just amazing you can walk.
It's a very, very nice image.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, that's great. No,
there was nothing pretty about it on the plane. There's nothing pretty about it off the plane. But
the miracle is still the word plane.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you got into a thing, and it went to 45,000 feet and yep. flew over, as opposed to sitting in this wooden crate constructed by drunks in the old country, and you sat in that thing for however long it took, subject to the whims of the wind.
Yeah.
With scurvy and mice and all kinds of other stuff. So you could have been in a mice-infested, scurvy-laden wooden ship.
I'll let you know. I think the jury's still out on the scurvy part.
No extra charge.
Yeah, that's right. They throw in the scurvy, but the mice you got to pay for. That's in first class.
But we'll see. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin is here. It's been a long time since I've seen Bob, and it's a thrill to have him back. Good morning.
Thanks, Joe. We made it through another year. We made it through commencement, so it's wonderful to be back. Two things. Today is actually National Waiter and Waitress Day, so if you're out, remember the people that help serve you, because a lot of times we forget about the service that they provide. And then a special shout-out to George Wendt. Norm was kind of one of those special characters that I related to growing up.
You know, we played a part of an interview that I did with him in, I think it was 2019, and it was just such a thrill to meet the guy. It was just, he's just such a sweet, lovely man, and we had just a blast. And I was really sad to see that yesterday. You know, I think by today's standards, 76, very young. So felt bad about it, and so we certainly say rest in peace to George Wendt this morning. When I was coming home yesterday, it was like it broke as a breaking news story in the Boston Globe. It was as if it was as if the mayor, something had happened. You know, it was like George Wendt died.
Whose popularity is probably higher than the mayor, actually.
Yeah, that's a good point. Former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years, now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Ambassador Fred Hoff joins us this morning. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Joe, delighted to be here. Welcome back. And I presume you've found that we and the British are still two people divided by a common language.
Yes. Yeah. That's a very good point. Fred, that's a very, very, very good point. We went out at one night with the family, went out, and we went to see a comedy show. And it was a blast. We had an amazing time. And there were six comics. I think I fully understood four of them. And it was great. Just really, really fun. But you're right. It sometimes – and now when I watch – television from any other country, but certainly from England. I do like to put on the closed captioning so I don't miss anything.
Turn the sound way up.
Yeah, so you don't miss anything. But you obviously you can't do that in a club.
That's tough. Yeah.
You just assume they're saying the F word a lot. Karen Riedel is with us, associate professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Dr. Karen Riedel, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm a little cold, I have to say, but I'm happy to be here.
You're cold, meaning you don't have a cold. You're just. Is it the studio or is it just walking? Just the temperature
walking
outside.
Walking from the parking lot.
Oh, okay.
Glad to be in the studio.
Well, if we can make this studio, I think I'm guessing the studio will heat up very quickly once we get started.
Is that because of hot air?
Nah, sure. Okay. Yeah, it's whatever you want to take out of that, Bob. All right, let's start and get to what's happening in the world. And as you know, there's a lot of stuff, so we'll get going here. And we welcome your input as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. No, O-R-G. They changed it. I'm sorry. I'm still on UK URLs. O-R-G is the panel at WAMC.org. Let's talk about the domestic policy bill, otherwise known as the Big Beautiful Bill. The president has went to the Capitol yesterday, went to Capitol Hill, to squeeze his party on the domestic policy bill as the GOP hunts for votes. And though that seems to be, it depends on who you ask and when, of how close they are. But the president visited the weekly meeting of House Republicans to make the case for the legislation and pressure members of his party to fall in line. Later, negotiations with key holdouts appeared to be bearing fruit. President Trump pressured House Republicans to unify around a wide-ranging bill to deliver his domestic agenda. Joining them at their weekly closed-door party meeting, Mr. Trump pushed Republicans to drop their reservations about the legislation and embrace the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which leaders hope to bring to a vote by the end of the week. The president made it clear that he saw the package as a test of loyalty to him, saying he had been a cheerleader for the party and warning that any holdouts wouldn't be a Republican much longer. And then later said that was not a threat, by the way. The entreaties from Mr. Trump on Tuesday morning appeared to do little to resolve the rifts that have plagued the measure for many weeks. Republicans emerged from the session saying they still were not sold and wanted further changes before they could back the bill. But by Tuesday evening, Speaker Mike Johnson's behind-the-scenes negotiations with lawmakers from divergent factions across this conference appeared to have yielded some progress. He told reporters at the Capitol that they were, quote, still finalizing things, but it's not going to be a heavy lift. Bob Griffin.
Oh, good Lord, Joe. It's not a heavy lift is kind of killing me. You know, when you think about at the macro level what we're talking about, I mean, we're talking about cutting health benefits for the poorest. We're talking about cutting food subsidies for children. And we're talking about adding $4 trillion, I think was the number that came out of the Congressional Budget Office, in order to give the richest in this country additional tax breaks. I mean, this is a heartless bill. And the sad part to me, though, is that when you look at some of the holdouts, I sort of drop them into two categories on the GOP side. One, you have, you know, the Chip Roy sort of Freedom Caucus who say that even the massive amount of cuts that they're talking about in services back to us is not going far enough. And then you have the sort of second group, and I put sort of Lawler and some others in that group, looking for a little bit more of tax equity with the SALT, the state and local tax payments being recognized at the federal government. I'm not quite as convinced that they're as close as they think they are. I also think that whatever comes out of the House is going to face a steep uphill climb in the Senate, given the fact that there seems to be a little more backbone in the Senate than we see with the House. So I think it's I'm really concerned about the overall budget. A couple other points about the budget that we should talk about. Puts a lot more money into defense, puts a lot more money into border security, basically reworks some key elements of how the country has operated. And if you look at the details, actually costs the people that make the least the most. So I guess in my heart of hearts, I do hope they struggle with it because I'm not seeing much of a moral code out of Congress right now.
But it is interesting to think that the people who are against it, many of the people, let me rephrase that, or even some of the people who oppose it are upset because it's not like doesn't go far
enough. Doesn't go far enough.
Right. Right. So it's not as if they think what is being done is cruel or concerning, as what you just pointed out of your concerns, that it does not go far enough. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from our other panelists this morning, Bob Bellafiore, Fred Hoff, and Dr. Karen Riedel on this subject. We welcome your input as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262, or WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm Ray Graff.
Hi, Ray.
Hello. It was a little surprise. I didn't know we were going right on the air.
Well, we did.
Okay.
Are you ready now?
Yeah, it's the lockbox, folks.
It is.
800-323-9262. I'll say it slower. 800-323-9262. Only a couple minutes here, Sarah,
right,
to remind people what we're doing and why.
We are trying to fill the lockbox to help shorten WAMC's summer fun drive. The fun drive begins at 6 a.m. on June 2nd, and the more money we can raise before then, the shorter the drive will be. And that's just math. Just math.
That's incredible. And we are almost at the $304,000 mark in this fun drive, which is insanely wonderful. We have a long way to go. Our fun drive is $1.25 million.
That's right.
But if people make that they want it to end, we won't have a fun drive. The fun drive begins Monday, June 2nd. And if we fill the lockbox right now, it's regular programming all day as opposed to fundraising all day.
That's right.
And that's the point of the lockbox, to limit the amount of interruption we will do on our regular programming. Go ahead.
1-800-323-9262. You are partway through, just the very, you know, the first segment of today's roundtable panel has just wrapped up. As we've taken over the airwaves, we will be giving you back to them very shortly. Mm-hmm. We just want to remind you that WAMC is here 24/7 without a paywall for everyone in the region, everyone in the world, if they have streaming ability, to tune in, to learn about what's going on in this area and the world. And if you believe that that is a valuable thing and you can afford to donate, we're asking that you do that now. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
And if you think about the commitment that people make just to be on the roundtable panel, Ambassador Fred Hoff and everyone else who comes in, they don't have to do this.
They don't.
It's not a payday.
It's not.
They do this because they believe in what they talk about.
They care to engage in the civics and news of the area and the world, and they give of their time and expertise on a regular basis. We are so grateful for them. And if you appreciate them as well and the rest of the programming on WAMC, please consider pledging now.
WAMC.org is the website. There's never a paywall, but there is a lovely button that will take you to make a pledge. And we encourage you to do that right now. Melinda in Salisbury, Connecticut says, love the station. She's listened since she's been here for 40 years.
Wow.
So, Melinda, thank you so much. Always great to hear from Connecticut. Thanks to Zaffer in Chatham, New York. Americans do not bow to kings. And thank you all for what you have done. We are closing in on 304,000, which is remarkable. Love to see us get to the quarterway point by the end of the roundtable today. And you and I will be back, what, a couple times?
Couple times.
And ask you again, if you haven't done it and you can do it, a couple of dollars will get us to that goal. 800-323-9262.
You can pledge by calling. We do have staff ready to speak with you and assist you in making your pledge. Or you can go online, as we've been saying, and pledge at WAMC.org. The lockbox is open and WAMC needs you now. Help us fill the lockbox, keep the fun drive as short as possible, and keep WAMC on the air. With your support, we will be here for many years to come, whether it is the people you know now or those that we train and leave the jobs to through the generations.
Or the station, AI robots that will take over at some point.
Oh, goodness. One hopes not. But
listen, there's talk about that. Not here, but there's talk about broadcasters being replaced by, you know, AI.
I don't want that to happen.
Well, we need a job, clearly. I mean, I guess I could just polish the robot.
Which is a hell of
a euphemism, isn't it?
I suppose
Can
it
you
is.
Say that? On
yeah,
the
I don't know. I went to confession. Hey, Father, I polished the robot. Okay. 800-323-9262. Hey, so Joe Donahue was in England.
Foggy London Town.
What were you doing there, Joe?
Well, I my smart ass answer is I was polishing the robot.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
Just visiting, being with family. It was a lovely time. But it's good to be back and to hear you all doing so well.
Do you have the jet lag?
Yes.
Yeah, you know what Pete Alonso said after they went to England to play some games? Jet lag is a state of mind. So just get over it. Get over it, young man.
Yeah, I will. I will.
Just immediately or over time, as it normally takes, which
That's
is
right.
going to be fine, too.
Just let it pass.
I don't travel. And frankly, you know, you don't get jet lag from coming back from Rensselaer, you know?
Well, maybe you don't. Lucky.
800-323-9262. Sarah, you and I are wasting time. We're only here for another 15 seconds, right?
Minute and 15 seconds.
Oh, really? Yeah. That long? WAMC.
I think we can fill it. Reminding the folks what we're trying to do here, which is fill the lockbox ahead of the fund drive. The closer we can get to the $1.25 million goal before the fund drive begins on June 2nd, the shorter that fund drive and programmas interruptus will be.
Indeed. All right. WAMC.org. Please do go. Please make a pledge. Or you can call. We do have volunteers here. And encourage a friend who has maybe never made a pledge. Maybe you listen to something that you have in common. Just say, listen, they need your support now. We don't want to hear them fundraise for 15 hours a day starting June 2nd. That's what the lockbox is about. You are keeping WAMC strong. You're ensuring that everybody, regardless of income, can access fact-based journalism, good cultural programming, conversations like you will hear in a moment on the roundtable panel. We need you at this point. 800-323-9262. We're crashed over the $304,000 mark.
Beautiful.
Sarah LaDuke.
Thank you, everyone.
Let's keep it rolling.
800-323-9262 to make a pledge with a phone call, or WAMC.org to do it with typing on a device. We return you now to the roundtable panel. Please keep pledging.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And thanks to Ray and Sarah for their beautiful work this morning in trying to make the case and to keep the to get the word out about the lockbox, and that you can help out. WAMC.org. We'll hear from them in just a little bit again, and we look forward to that. In the meantime, we are talking about the domestic policy bill, the big beautiful bill, as it has been called and titled. And we heard from Bob Griffin. Let's go to other members of our panel. Dr. Karen Riedel.
All right. Thank you. Well, thanks, Bob, for the introduction to the big, beautiful bill. And I just realized it sank in yesterday. This is what I'm going to have to refer it to when we move along, because this will be passed. And so in the future, I will have to talk about the big, beautiful act that was passed in 2025. And it is, of course, an act that shows no empathy for the most vulnerable, as Bob said.
I think you could just call it the abomination. It would probably be easier.
There's a lot you can do with the alliteration. That would be fun if you wanted.
but the
big bombastic act, big BS act.
Yeah, there's.
I can help with that.
But the holdouts, as you say, they're not about making the bill any more empathetic to the needs of the vulnerable. They're about cutting them more. The outcomes will make the bill even harsher. Even the more moderate Republicans argue for greater tax cuts. That is it. That is the extent of the discussion. It will be passed. I do, however, appreciate seeing pushback to an administration that is so hands-on. And I cannot remember, can anybody remember a time when the president was so hands-on in legislative affairs?
Yes. Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah. You
have
to be older than you are.
You have to be older.
But LBJ was...
But a president's going to Congress to lobby is like in the top drawer. It's the first play in the playbook. Strong-arming... arm twisting is one thing. Lyndon Johnson would call people into the Oval Office and lobby them while he was doing his business in the toilet. You want to talk about intimidation 101. He'd come out of the shower and towel himself down and make people stand there while he was berating them.
Well, that took a turn.
Well, Ray started it. But by the way, there's I got a news alert. Tipper Gore now wants to put a warning label on Ray Graff.
On Ray, yes.
So this sort of lobbying of Congress is part of the job if you're the president. And if the president has an initiative and Congress isn't paying attention and people want the president, they go, why isn't the White House engaging with Congress? This is part of the job. This is part of how the two separate branches of government operate. And presidents have all kinds of different styles. Barack Obama used to send Joe Biden down to Congress because he was one of them, right? Trump's got his style. We know Trump's style. Climb up the ladder, get in the steamroller, fire it up, and go.
But I certainly don't want to speak on your behalf, Karen. But it seems to me what you were getting at was the fact that this idea of going to the Capitol and then saying, oh, by the way, if you don't do what I want you to do, we'll make sure you don't have your job anymore.
And of course, these ongoing discussions will lead to some of these representatives losing their jobs. So I do embrace, for that reason, these ongoing discussions that bring this enormous bill, the details of it, out into the air, emphasize the impact it will have on the constituents of many of these Republican House representatives. And it's to make the general public more aware of how they and their neighbors are going to be impacted. And yes, I do think it will make a difference in the upcoming election.
Fred. Yeah, the House Rules Committee started its work trying to finalize this piece of legislation at 1 a.m. this morning, and I presume they're continuing. As I think of the lobbying efforts of LBJ back in the day, whether he was working on the Civil Rights Act or whatever. Johnson worked his charms on both Democrats and Republicans. Okay. Nowadays, and I guess this isn't news anymore, but what's going on in the Rules Committee is simply between Republicans. There is no outreach by the Speaker of the House to his Democratic Party counterpart, and I guess this is just the way the system works now. Reading the Wall Street Journal this morning, I discovered that this bill would cut Medicaid funding by about $625 billion and would require able-bodied recipients to work, volunteer, et cetera, et cetera. It would reduce funding to states that offer Medicaid coverage to undocumented immigrants. It would also reduce eligibility for the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the bill would decrease Medicaid enrollment by 10.3 million people by 2034. What's interesting to me, one of the many things that's interesting to me, is that these Medicaid changes in particular would not take effect. They would not go into effect until 2029. This allows voters not to feel the pinch during the balance of President Trump's term. It also gives Democrats a campaign issue, both in the midterms and the 2028 presidential campaign, where they're going to say, in essence, vote for us, and we'll make sure that these restrictions don't come into effect. I have to say that what concerns me the most is the impact of all of this on our budgetary deficit and national debt in this country. Ever since 2001, when President Bush decided to pay for the global war on terror with a credit card after having inherited a budgetary surplus, but paying for it on a credit card instead of asking the American people in the wake of 9/11 to make a sacrifice. Ever since then, we've been running obscene deficits under Republicans and Democrats alike. President Trump's bill would increase these projected deficits by $3 trillion by 2034. before very long, our national debt is going to exceed the actual value of our entire economy. Now, nobody, I don't think there's an economist out there who is able to tell you when we actually go off the cliff economically because of the size of the debt. Obviously, servicing this debt is going to cost more and more as time goes on, especially with high interest rates. The fact is, Democrats want to cut nothing. Republicans want to extend big tax cuts. Americans in general want all these government services but are reluctant to pay for them. And they elect politicians who fully reflect this something-for-nothing attitude. Real fiscal conservatives, people who want to eliminate annual deficits and stabilize the national debt, really have no political home in this country anymore, neither in the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party, and they have virtually no constituency, I'm afraid, in the public.
No more calls. We have a winner.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will get to our listener letters. We have many of those. We'll include yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we'll hear more from our Lockbox team coming up just after the top of the hour, but you can still help out, WAMC.org or 1-800-323-9262. And again, we'll hear from Ray and Sarah after the top of the hour. Let us go to letters that we have on the topic of the domestic policy bill that is being worked on as we speak. Kerry writes, I sense that Senator Josh Hawley is pivoting away from Trump ever so slightly as he speaks out against FEMA cuts and Medicaid cuts on behalf of his state of Missouri. He probably sees the writing on the wall that MAGA is losing popularity, and he is positioning himself to run for president, probably against J.D. Vance one day. That from Kerry. Please let us not forget that the big disastrous bill is a foregone conclusion thanks to the support of Chuck Schumer's caving in to Trump during the budget fight a while back, says Jim. What did he think he was going to happen? That they would find a collective consciousness and support the regular American people instead of the rich ones? Give me a break.
And I think this is putting the letter writer just put his finger on a big problem for the Democrats: is what do they stand for, and you know what is the policy difference that the Democrats offer from the Republicans right now, and I think the idea of just sitting back and being silent and is not the type of leadership that the country needs. But it's really hard to articulate the differences. And during break, Bob, I'll turn to you for a second. The idea of, what it's the center. When you think about where the true votes in this country are, it's not on the two wings. It's in the center, but it's the center that is continuing to be silenced.
Joe, do you have more listener stuff that you want to go to? Because they pay the bills. We just fill the air. So let's talk to the people who pay the bills.
I do have more letters, if that's what you're referring to.
It's your show, although
well,
we can change
you.
That.
Well, thank you for I will I appreciate that. You go away for 5 days and everything just goes. Let's see. David writes, with all the proposed Medicaid cuts and kicking it back to the states, many of whom won't do anything to make up for it, I want to know how many additional dead or prematurely dead Americans are too many for the Republicans to get their immense billionaire tax cuts. Are 5,000 additional premature dead Americans per year too many? The estimates are that 10 million people will be thrown off Medicaid is 10,000 additional dead Americans every single year going forward, an acceptable death toll for Republican billionaire tax cuts. Are 20,000 additional dead Americans every single year too high a toll for Republican billionaire tax cuts? What does the conscience of the conservative tell you? That from David. Then we go to Rachel. I think it's important not to parrot talking points. Please stop calling it the Big Beautiful Bill. Well, here's the problem. As Karen pointed out, that's the name of it.
Right.
That's the name of it. That would be like, so stop talking about, stop calling it Gone with the Wind. Well, that is the name of the book. We can't, you know, so, okay. Over and over and over, you are spreading propaganda because if someone tunes in briefly, they don't hear your criticism. Well, I don't know that that's the case.
All I know is don't tune in briefly. Listen to the whole show.
They hear you refer to the bill in emphatic terms. Please stop carrying water for Trump unless you really favor passage of the bill.
The listener has, of course, makes a very important point. Language is powerful, and while we may be criticizing and taking issue with it, if the terms matter, and most of our fellow citizens don't have the opportunity to delve as deeply into the subject matter as we do, and it's for those people who these words will really linger and impact their perspective. So I appreciate the viewpoint she shared with us.
Yeah, you know, and it happens all the time. I mean, the Build Back America Better bill. I mean, all these things have poll driven, clever little names, and they get parroted all across by the media, by people on highly intellectual chat shows like this, and it becomes short.
That's very British.
Mm. Yes, yes.
Chat shows.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Good show, boy. But it happens with everything, right? It's what they call it, so it becomes media shorthand. You just live with it both ways.
Well, and I agree with you because, I mean, you think of the various, while no names come, Fred, you probably could come up with these, but we do this with military operations, Operation Freedom, Passion for the Cause, or whatever the case be. So that's what they call them, and they become the shorthand.
Yeah, it's all part of the Hearts and Minds campaign.
Of what they do. I understand the concern on the listener's point of view, of course.
You could just call it the tax bill, and then everyone will go to sleep.
We go to Vincent, who says, stop sane-washing Trump's illegal and unconstitutional activity. There's nothing legitimate in what he is doing. He is a damn criminal and should not have been allowed to run. Okay, but how are we sane-washing? But he is extorting members of Congress, destroying the economy, the stock market, trashing our relationships with allies, and cozying up to the most evil dictators on the planet. And stop talking in generalizations about what Americans want. It's far more nuanced than that. Why don't you talk about how the most wealthy in our nation benefit from the labor of others and how they absolutely refuse to pay their fair share and continue with their boots on the necks of others? That from Vincent.
Someday I'm going to ask for a definition of fair share. You know, the top 1% of the country pays 45% of the federal tax bill. The top 50% of earners pay 97% of the federal tax bill. So what does fair share mean? All of it?
Well, I think when people hear that you know, what did Trump pay in taxes? You know, and when you look at when I look at my tax bill or I'm sure you look at your tax bill and you realize that in real money you paid more than he did. I think that's a big issue. I also heard a really interesting statistic this morning on I think it was on CNN that in the last year alone, Musk made $186 billion. The top 10 richest Americans earned $1 billion a day every day in the last year. I think that's part of the conversation about who is paying what. We also need to realize how much wealth is in the hands of such a small number of people right now. And continue to have the conversations about what is fair. It's also the conversations about what services should a developed country be offering. And you know, personally, no, I don't think it's I don't think it's right that in this country that there isn't proper medical care or that we would allow children to starve. So these are all, I think, really valid conversations that we should be having. The problem, and I picked on the Democrats a minute ago, I'll pick on the GOP right now. What's your vision for this country? All right, you put this in, you put these tax cuts in, you know, what is your vision for this country? What does it look like? What does the future look like? And I can't get this from either party.
Wasn't that what last year's campaign was about? I mean, is anybody in this room surprised at Trump's budget bill, tax bill? Anybody surprised?
No. I mean, I think it's as advertised, right?
Well, no, I just mean like, you know, he's cutting taxes, he's cutting spending. Who's surprised? I'm not surprised. So that was what the whole campaign was about. So like in your jobs, right? Global affairs, right? International affairs, cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens. It's like, well, how did we get here? How do we go back to find the thing, right? That was the whole 9/11 investigation. What did we miss way back when that figured out, that helped us figure out how we get here? So how did we get to this position where Trump, as president, elected after 4 years of lawsuits and impeachments and January 6th, all that stuff? How is it that he got to become president again with a Republican Congress? They articulated what they were about. And the other side, as we're seeing now, finally come out in Jake Tapper's book and in all the conversations now, had no idea what they were doing and were trying and were completely disorganized, or I would say malorganized. It wasn't just they were disorganized. They were actively hurting their case against Trump. Everybody on the every Democrat knew, considered Trump a clear and present danger. And what they did to counter that was what you're seeing now in the Tapper book and in a million other places. So complain all you want, disagree with what's in the Trump tax bill, but don't act shocked.
Yeah, as one of my favorite Wall Street Journal columnists put it the other day, democracy is not about good government. It's about self-government. People made some choices. And you know, we're gonna be living with them one way or the other.
In a democracy, people get the government they deserve.
Yes.
We need to take a break, and we will do exactly that. My thanks to everyone here, and we'll move on to other topics in the other on the other side of this break. We welcome you in two ways. If you would like to comment on anything that we're talking about, panel at WAMC.org, or to help us during our lockbox push, panel, it's WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. We'll be back with news and lockbox talk and all of that after this.
1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. Those are important to remember.
They are important to remember because those are the methods by which you can support WAMC if you are a listener and can afford to donate. Support the station, help us fill the lockbox, and shorten the fund drive.
Well, you want to hear a number?
Yeah.
Here's where we're at in the entire fund drive, which, by the way, begins June 2nd, Monday, June 2nd. We are at $304,506.
Beautiful. Thank you, everybody, for calling up and pledging so far today and throughout this week. We're so grateful for everyone who has shown up so far. Let me thank a few people who have pledged. Thanks to Jerry. Vowel shift.
Okay.
Thanks to Jerry and Myra of Saugerties, New York. So the only station we think we're hearing the truth and we love it. We heard from Anonymous in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, who says it's wonderful programming. And Anonymous in Troy, New York, says Addict for WAMC listens every morning.
You know, anything you can say, I can say better. And thanks to
Anonymous. That's probably true.
No, you can't. You don't want to sing?
You want me to? It is 10:07 on day three of the lockbox. Okay. I don't think it's time for my Ethel Merman impression.
I withdraw the suggestion entirely. Thanks to Anonymous of Queensbury, New York. Thank you for everything. You're glad to be a new sustaining member. Sustaining membership, very cool. We will tell you about that in a moment. Thanks to Hal in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Damien and Jane in Monson, Mass.
Damien!
They say she just loves the station and been listening forever.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. What are you doing?
It's from The Omen.
That's what I
Gregory
thought.
Gregory Peck from
I was
going to
say,
Damien.
Is that from
Damien.
The Omen? And instead I said, what are you doing?
800-323-9262. Well, I don't know what we're doing.
You got to love Gregory Peck.
Indeed. We'll go back to the roundtable panel shortly, but we're here to fill the lockbox. You know, I'm not an optimistic fella. You know me a long time.
I do by now.
I'm a glass, a quarter full kind
You're
of fella.
You're a glass shattered in the garbage.
Yeah, that sort of thing. But if everybody stepped up and made a pledge in the next hour of the roundtable, we could hit the quarterway point where less than $8,000 to go. We need you.
It's a lot of money.
It is. And it's a short amount of time.
Many hands make light work.
There's no challenge. It doesn't matter specifically if we get it today or a little later. But the idea is to have the lockbox brimming over the top so that there is no fun drive on June 2nd. We can do it. If you feel like it, and you know, you've heard in the media, federal funding could be stripped from public stations and WAMC and everybody else.
Yep, it's they're working really hard to try to do that.
And we have always relied on you. You are part of how this garden grows, and we need you more than ever to stay independent. The number is 800-323-9262. The website is WAMC.org.
WAMC doesn't belong to the government. It doesn't belong to corporations. It belongs to you, our community of listeners. And that means the only thing standing between us and silence on these airwaves is you. You can help us stand strong by pledging at WAMC.org or giving us a call at 1-800-323-9262. As Ray mentioned a few moments ago, you can become a sustaining member. That's a monthly donor who provides a steady, reliable support. Your pledge at whatever monthly amount you set it at. Level of support.
Close enough.
Grammar, she comes and she goes,
we
doesn't
get your
she?
Gist. Yes, I got that email too.
But you can set however much you'd like to give. Set it and forget it, as they say. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Become a sustainer, make a one-time donation, whatever, however you want to, you know, parse it out, swing it out, give it to us, we're ready.
And you know, the roundtable panel is something that is much more than a program. It's an argument. No, it's a place where different views come together, different communities are represented. This is something you hear in public radio, but not even throughout public radio. This is unique to us, to you, to everyone who has made it happen. And if you've given a dollar to this station, you've helped make it happen. The number is 800-323-9262.
1-800-323-9262. And without further ado, we will hand you back to the capable hands of Joe Donahue and the Roundtable panel. Are you all ready in there?
Indeed.
Great.
Ready to go.
Marvelous.
Ready to roll.
Thank okay. you. 800-323-9262.
I just want to vote and say that there is no time too early for your Ethel Merman impression.
My vocal cords might disagree.
Well, that's another case. But as far as the audience goes, we're always ready, willing, and able.
I think you'll regret it. Have a great time in there. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Keep it coming for the effort to fill the lockbox. And you've been doing a great job, and we need you to keep doing it. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Let me remind you who we have on the program, especially if you are just joining us. Bob Bellafiore is here, Bob Griffin is here, Fred Hoff, and Dr. Karen Riedel join us, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to a new topic for this 10 o'clock hour and talk about deportations to South Sudan. This is a story that is similar to other stories that we've covered on deportation, but the latest. A federal judge on Tuesday evening ordered the Trump administration not to let a group of migrants being transported to South Sudan leave the custody of U.S. immigration authorities. U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy in Boston wrote that the Trump administration must not let the migrants being transported to South Sudan out of their custody to ensure that the migrants will be able to be returned to the United States if the court finds that their attempted deportations are unlawful. The order also applies to other migrants being deported to any third country, meaning nations where deported migrants are not citizens. The court, Murphy wrote, would leave the practicalities of compliance, quote unquote, to the discretion of the defendants, which include the Department of Homeland Security, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, and U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi. Murphy wrote that the defendants must answer several questions during an upcoming hearing scheduled for Wednesday, that's today, including the amount of notice each migrant received ahead of their attempted removal to South Sudan and any details about their current whereabouts. The order came in response to an emergency request from the lawyers from a group of migrants who asked Murphy to intervene after indications that federal immigration authorities may have deported up to a dozen immigrants from Vietnam and other countries to South Sudan. You want in first, Fred?
Sure, Joe. Well, just a little background. South Sudan became an independent country in 2011. From 2013 until 2020, there was a particularly vicious civil war that featured a lot of ethnic cleansing, large-scale ethnic slaughter. And not to put too fine a point on it, but genocidal activities. Since 2020, it's been governed a bit shakily by the leaders of the 7-year civil war. The security situation today remains very, very, very dicey. Now, you know, on the one hand, I think undocumented aliens in the United States really ought to take full responsibility for having jumped the line and gotten into the country without a visa. We are entitled as a country to determine who gets in and who doesn't. I certainly don't begrudge people who want to escape terrible, bad circumstances in their own countries, who want to come to the United States to seek opportunity. Normally, we're better off for it. But if they're here without proper documentation, they need to take full responsibility for their status, even if they're offered due process. And my own view is that anybody on American soil is entitled to due process. On the other hand, I think sending people to places like South Sudan, Libya, another one under discussion, unless they are South Sudanese and Libyans, is cruel and unusual. If our government's motive is to encourage self-deportation by offering the prospect of being shipped to violently dysfunctional parts of the planet, as far as I know, that may be the real motive here. But regardless of the motive, I'm personally disappointed that any American official would consider sending people to such hellacious places. It strikes me as gratuitously cruel and inhuman, something that that all of us, I think especially people of faith, ought to find very, very, very objectionable.
Bob?
I'll sort of echo Fred's comments. And for listeners at home, if you haven't followed what's going on in South Sudan, it's actually, I think it's worse than what Fred was saying. It's not just the civil war. It's continued to be famine. It's the state-sponsored rape and murder. And what we the people through our government are doing right now is that we're taking folks when I was looking at the population that was sent to South Sudan, Philippines, Vietnam. I mean, so we're not talking about people who came from
Myanmar.
The region.
Yeah.
Myanmar. We basically dump them into a war zone that. That doesn't have the resources right now to handle their own people, let alone an influx of others. I would say put a stronger point on it. I actually think it's sadistic. I think it's absolutely sadistic that we are adopting a national policy that basically is condoning the disappearing of these people, because once they're on the ground in South Sudan, there is no guarantee of their safety. Coming into the country illegally, I understand your point. Being deported should not be a death sentence. And in reality, that is exactly what we're running when we're deporting people to an environment like South Sudan. And frankly, I think the officials who have come up with this idea should be held accountable.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's just a couple of years ago when the United Kingdom tried a very similar approach with Rwanda. And in the end, it was I had to look it up what the title is, the High Court of Justice in the United Kingdom eventually ruled that it could not be done because Rwanda was not a safe enough country. Now, Rwanda, compared to South Sudan, is a model country. It is, compared to South Sudan, it is politically and economically a model country. I'm deeply appalled.
Fred, you laid it out perfectly. The first part of your statement about the responsibility that people who came here illegally, you, by the way, you're going to get disappeared from this program by using the word aliens, just saying.
I think you're safe, Fred.
as long as you don't talk about mushrooms or robots. What you laid out, I think, is where the American people are. That we're a nation of laws, we're allowed to have regulated borders, and unregulated borders have created a massive problem. I am generally okay with, what they say, sending people back where they came from, right? And I think people would support that. But sending people into a place like South Sudan, where they're not from, is like the old custom of throwing sacrifices into a live volcano.
Yeah.
And it may be that in time, this gets considered a peace crime, not a war crime, but a peace crime, where you're sending people against their will into a place where they're just like getting thrown to wolves, thrown into a volcano. We can spend the next hour doing metaphors on what this is. This is classic of this administration. They're on an idea that the American public supports and would be with if it was a little more sensible, and then they just take it too far. And it's like, a little gold on that wall would be nice. And then Trump makes it all gold and makes it look totally gaudy, like a bad catering house on Long Island, right? They need to just like pull it back and think about it for a second, and we'll see what maybe they're within their rights to do it legally, and in which case the law's got to be changed. But this is a classic example of them taking a position that the American public are with them on, and just going too far, where it becomes sadistic, an atrocity, whatever word you want to put on it, but inhumane.
And to add on to that, it's a typical pattern of this administration is that they don't seem to consider the long-term consequences these actions have on our standing in the world and our ability to maintain allies, rebuild alliances over the long run. It's what kind of society do we want to be? What kind of image do we want to send to the world of who we are?
Bob?
I can't disagree. I'll go back to it's a death penalty. I mean, you know, understand that, you know, when we're deporting and we're not giving these folks a lot of resources. So, I mean, they don't have the capacity. If you're from Vietnam and you're being dumped in South Sudan, you don't have necessarily any resources that you can count on. So it's not like you're going to be able to get back to Vietnam. So what happens to those people? And you know, Bob, I appreciate the comment about taking it too far. When will we hold people who take it too far accountable? And I think that's another issue that we need to put on the table of, okay, we have people who are supposed to be acting in on behalf of the American people, who are doing these things that are in my mind push the boundaries of their of fiduciary and authoritative responsibilities, and they should be held accountable for it. Especially, we haven't really talked that much about the fact that this is also flying in the face of what the courts have said. So once again, we're up against an administration that is running, you know, basically thumbing its nose at the court system, where it's an administration that continues to say that the laws don't apply. But at the same time, we're making an argument that, well, people are violating the laws. That's why they're here illegally. I mean, the law either applies or it doesn't. Okay, and with this administration, it picks and chooses what it wants to do, and frankly, I think it's really dangerous for the country.
Bob,
yeah, Bob, your point about the courts is really apt, but you know, let's not think for a sec. One, the courts have a process to it, and it is a long, slow, laborious process, and there are lower courts and middle courts and highest courts, And court decisions get overturned more than pancakes in a diner on a Sunday morning. So keep in mind that there is a process, and it is not final until the highest court that is willing to take the case speaks, right? And a lot of these cases, it'll be the Supreme Court. Just like you have people who feel like the Supreme Court has been politicized, there's an argument there. There's also a decent argument that the lower federal courts have been politicized. Because of appointments and how they get done and the kind of people that get appointed to judgeships and how that happens. So this is not perfect, but it's the best, it's the worst except for all the others. And I can see the White House saying, well, we'll wait till the final court rules because this is a first round decision by a lower level federal judge who is appointed by the other guy. There's an argument there.
But they're still ignoring what the courts are saying. And I don't disagree with you that the court systems run slowly, which is really scary when you're looking at policies that are being put in place that the argument from members of Congress is, well, you know, his executive orders, which should have been through the legislative process first rather than an executive order, will be overturned by the courts. The other thing that I would respectfully remind everybody is that, the laws can be changed, systems can be updated. It's criminal how few immigrant judges there, you know, immigration judges there are. I mean, those to me are a question of resources and priorities that could have and should have been fixed. And it could have started with Congress. They could have put more resources there, and they've decided not to. And now they're pearl clutching over over how slow the courts are going.
Yeah, and I think Karen makes an excellent point asking the question. Just how smart is this policy? How intelligent is it? in terms of broader American interests. I mean, is it really worth it for the United States to endure, God forbid, a front page story about some person from Myanmar being slaughtered in South Sudan, when you're talking about at most, you know, moving maybe a few dozen people? Is it worth it? Is it worth what you're sacrificing in terms of American soft power to have a truly exotic policy like this? Sending people to to really bad places. We recently lost a very, very, very important member of our home team as Americans, Professor Joe Nye of Harvard, who was the one who really defined and popularized the idea of soft power, the idea that people would be attracted to the United States because of the ideals we stand for, and because of the way we behave. I'm afraid that this policy of trying to deposit people in places like Libya, South Sudan runs completely counter to that. I don't want to sound like an apologist for South Sudan, but I should make the point that the situation there is different from the situation just to the north in Sudan proper, where genocide is an ongoing problem. South Sudan is relatively stable right now, but it is not the place where the United States has any business depositing people against their will.
What America stands for internationally is a pressing question, and it what was exposed during Vietnam. What is it that we're about, right? And so this isn't a new thing about how our global actions raise questions about what we're about and whether we're hypocrites about human rights or all the things we think are important that are in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We will handle one more story. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll go back into some lockbox action after this. Welcome back to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 21st of May. Karen Riedel, Fred Hoff, Bob Griffin, and Bob Bellafiore with us on this Wednesday morning. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We have about 10, 12 minutes for one more topic to discuss before we go back to our lockbox crew and hear their important message this morning. You can get in on that early, WAMC.org. So we go to this story regarding the former governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, after the Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation of Andrew Cuomo, a frontrunner in the New York City mayoral race, after Republicans accused him of lying to Congress about decisions he made during the coronavirus pandemic as governor, according to two people familiar with the matter. The inquiry began about a month ago by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, comes after senior Justice Department officials in February demanded the dismissal of an indictment of the city's current mayor, Eric Adams, on corruption charges. That puts the Trump administration in the unusual position of having ended a criminal case against the leader of the nation's largest city and opened one into his chief rival in the span of a few months. Mr. Adams is running for re-election as an independent. Mr. Cuomo was leading the Democratic primary field in the polls. The existence of the investigation is sure to fuel further criticism that President Trump and his administration are wielding the Justice Department as a cudgel to achieve political ends and punish his perceived enemies. Mr. Trump routinely calls for criminal inquiries of political foes and people who have crossed him, often based on what legal experts say are flimsy claims of wrongdoing. His appointees at the Justice Department have increasingly signaled a willingness to use their investigation, their investigative and prosecutorial work to carry out Mr. Trump's wishes. The people familiar with the details of the investigation into Mr. Cuomo spoke on the condition of anonymity. A spokesman for the Justice Department and a spokeswoman for the FBI declined to comment. Meanwhile, Rich as a party, a spokesman for Mr. Cuomo, questioned the basis of the investigation. We have never been informed of any such matter, so why would someone leak it now? He said, the answer is obvious. This is lawfare and election interference, plain and simple, something President Trump and his top Department of Justice officials say they are against. That from the New York Times. Bob Bellafiore.
So I've been covering the Cuomo. I started covering the Cuomos in 1986, which is to say I've heard a lot of what they do and I'm old. Two, they always leave a roadmap. And the media, including the New York Times in this case, bite on it like a little leaguer with an ice pop after a ball game. They go right after it and swallow the whole thing whole. I had $2 to bet. Why would they release this now? The federal government hasn't said anything. I think it's a very good bet that Cuomo leaked this. Why? Because this is a great story for Cuomo in the mayoral race, where the progressives, which basically everybody else in the race except Eric Adams, are saying he is a Trump clone. He's too close to Trump. They're right. Trump and Cuomo are brothers from different mothers. They have the same makeup. They have the same attitude on things. They have the same level of ruthlessness. They have each of them has one picture in their wallet, and that's their own. So when his spokesman says, we haven't been notified, he is probably literally telling the truth. This is the thing. You can mislead and never get caught in a lie. And the Cuomos are fabulous at that. So this is, and there is no way if Trump wanted to damage Cuomo that he would that his Justice Department would put out a story that says Trump is after Cuomo. And notice now Cuomo is using all the same language that Trump used about the lawsuits against him. So it creates separation. It means he's not Trump. If I was Trump, why would he be investigating me? And the media and the New York Times, the most valuable real estate in American journalism, bites on it like a hungry fish on a worm.
Fred?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting thing to consider whether the Cuomo camp or the former governor leaked it, and obviously the New York Times story would suggest otherwise. I have no objective knowledge as to whether or not Governor Cuomo lied during the course of congressional testimony. If he did. And if there is indeed a careful investigation that leads prosecutors to believe he did, then he's certainly a valid target for prosecution. I do believe that there's a burden on the Department of Justice to demonstrate that this particular investigation has no link to the dismissal of charges against Mayor Adams, and is not. A form of lawfare that's injecting the federal government into the politics in New York City. I hope that the Department of Justice feels this burden and will act accordingly. At the end of the day, reputation is everything. I totally get the Attorney General's enthusiastic support of President Trump. And I don't consider this to be a hanging offense, but I would think she would feel a duty to safeguard the department's reputation and her own. And even if the motive is to support Mayor Adams by trying to take down Mr. Cuomo legally, the possibility, and you allude to this, the possibility of all this backfiring to Governor Cuomo's benefit should be taken into consideration. after all, a major beneficiary of relentless prosecution in the courts was none other than Donald Trump.
Bob?
You know, the just a couple of points that I will add to this is I listened to you, Bob, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting because I can't say it's wrong. And at the same time, the level of incompetence that I've seen out of the Department of Justice, I can't say that they're absolved right now. So, I mean, there's this sort of like, you know, rock 'em sock 'em robots right now. I don't know. That was for you, Ray. I don't know who's right in this. I mean, my sarcastic comment about it is, you know, lying to Congress. It's not like the leadership in Congress would know the truth even if it bit them. So I mean, I think that's really interesting. I still don't think I would still like to understand more about how the corruption charges against Adams were dropped and the decisions that were there, especially since I actually was respected the some of the prosecutors that were involved in the case and several of whom resigned afterwards in protest to that activities. So this whole thing, Joe, stinks.
Yeah.
It's funny, Rob, you say about lying to Congress. Why is that a crime? My sort of general view is you're not allowed to lie until you get in Congress.
I didn't say I wasn't about to cry. It was just the fact that yeah. You know
how ironic it is.
Exactly. Yeah. About you know about what's truth and what's not.
All right, Karen.
Bob, I'm so intrigued by that theory that Cuomo campaign leaked it themselves. I like the two theories that are presented here, but I'm intrigued by that. I could buy it very easily. Do you think there's a chance of it backfiring? If that was in fact the case, my initial reaction is anybody's was like, oh, he's going to benefit from that. Is there a chance that it's going to backfire? And especially in the system that we have in New York City for the Democratic primaries, the ranked choice system, is there a possibility that it's going to cost him something?
Yeah, always. I mean, you know, the dynamic is the other candidate in this ranked choice voting, which for the normal people who don't pay attention to how ballots are run in the five boroughs, you list your first, second, and third choice, and then unless somebody gets over a certain percentage, I think it's 50%,
right.
Then you just recalculate based on who your other choices are. So you could get not one first place vote. You could be second or third in everybody's ballot and end up being the mayor, having nobody voted for you to be mayor as their first choice. So the strategy among the progressives in New York City is for no one to rank Andrew Cuomo anywhere. So he can get all the first place votes he wants. As long as he doesn't get under 50%, he won't be the mayor. And then he could actually get 49% of the vote in the first round and not be mayor and get knocked out in the second round. So sure this could backfire, but the Cuomo strategy is very much like the Trump strategy. I want to dominate every news cycle. Right. And he, you know, he's a news cycle driven politician. And this, if you look at it from a campaign strategy, what are one of his liabilities? I am seen as too close to Trump. How do I get separation from Trump? Right. Well, he's investigating me. Why would he investigate me if I was close? See, and in New York City to be mayor, you have to be able to show you can fight the bad guy, show you can fight Orange Man. And this is a good way to say, well, he's trying to put me in jail. How could I possibly be his friend?
It may, however, remind a lot of people of the image of him as being a corrupt leader.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So.
But he has behind. But you know, a lot of your points were really interesting.
Wrap up, but go ahead.
Sure. Real quick, he could become the victim, and then even any criticism then is washed away because I'm just being picked on.
Yeah, and he can shout out the criticism because he's got tons of money.
We're going to end there and put a bookmark in our conversation. I'm sure this will come up again soon. We certainly want to thank Bob Bellafiore, Bob Griffin, Fred Hoff, and Karen Riedel for being with us this morning. Thank you all for your great thoughts and sharing with us this morning. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with a lockbox update and get you involved in the process. WAMC.org.